I'm not leaving right now because I'm pretty much in business. I'm pretty safe.
Are you illegal?
Yeah.
Are you illegal?
Yeah, he didn't help us until now.
Dave, I don't know. You know, it's real funny about oral arguments. A guy, you might burst an oral argument.
Uh-huh. Oh, you're not kidding.
To collateral estoppel. And we do have some precedent from the Fifth Circuit in the Aerojet case to that effect. But because I believe that my time is so constrained that, and I'm not criticizing that, I'm just saying because it is, I am going to assume for these purposes that federal law applies to collateral estoppel and to the question of res judicata. The court did not grant the writ as it applies to the banks and to the main herdman, and obviously it will have to dispose of those substantive questions, and but time again prevents any more than saying that this was a motion for summary judgment in which the court necessarily determined below that there were no fact issues, with the burden being on the other side. We say there is necessarily a fact issue as to when, in fact, the plaintiffs discovered the fraud about which they complained. And that alone denies the right to sustain the summary judgment as to those parties. We further say that when the acts were amended to place fraud alongside a debt, the four-year statute, we say, applies, not the two. The Court of Appeals had written that in another opinion before we argued this case in Odessa, but withdrew that following your opinion involving a legal malpractice claim in which you said tort claims go under 2 years. The same argument was not made, but those are the points applicable to the statute of limitations questions. We say that four-year statute applied, plus there was issue of fact of when they knew and discovered this fraud. But getting to the meat in the coconut, which seems to be a little bit hard to extract, we want to deal with the res judicata question that the Court of Appeals held was applicable so as to protect these parties against whom we say the basis of this cause of action. And to some extent that's got to be discussed, what we have sued for here and what claims were in the prior action heard by Judge Bunton. We have claimed here DDPA claims against them, common law fraud and statutory fraud and conspiracy relating to common law causes of action against these directors. In the prior action by cross-claim, wherein the government was trying to collect its note, the FDIC took the bank over and was trying to get its note as quickly as they could, as they always do. I don't know if the court has had much observation of how the FDIC works and its powers, but they move with considerable dispatch, and they have special statutes protecting them from any of the so-called stateside defenses, a special holder in due course statute. But in any event, some 9 months after this loan was made, the bank cratered. The FDIC took it over and then sued Eagle and its two general partners on the concept that they'd signed these notes, and that's it. The case was heard in 84 A cross action was filed, however, by Eagle and its principals, alleging that by way of a set off and recoupment, that the Fraser, the president of the bank, and the management of the bank had defrauded these gentlemen and Eagle Patrol, Eagle Properties, which was organized solely for this lease sale act that was involved.
You said and a cross action or a counterclaim?
It was a counterclaim. It was not a third party claim, Your Honor, which is important to making the distinctions that Jeans and Henderson made. They also alleged in that counterclaim, but it was not a claim for damages. It was merely to get out of the often of the recoupment and set off. They also alleged that there had been a violation of federal securities laws involved in the transaction. The judge, trial judge, as the court knows from looking at the briefs, found that there was no fraud in that transaction as far as the management was concerned, and primarily because they didn't seem to rely on the representations of the market value in their buildings. But he held them wrong about that. The FDIC, under the special statute, was a holder in due course and cut off any of these claims. And then, of course, it was appealed and settled on appeal, but with the FDIC, the petitioners here undertaking to reserve their rights against these very parties that have sought and obtained the benefit of the prior judgment. Now, the Court of Appeals upheld the summary judgment on the basis of this court's holding in Jeans versus Henderson, and on the concept that there was either privity, as developed in Jeans or federal law, between them and the bank in Fraser, and in the findings relating to fraud. Or, failing in that, we could have asserted by a third party action in this note collection case the federal securities claim that we had made in our counterclaim, and then pled all these things we now plead. And that would have been pendant to that litigation. And since we have not demonstrated that Judge Button would not have clearly entertained that total collateralization of that lawsuit, that they can attach themselves to that judgment and get the benefit of those findings, so that they don't have any, that's all there is to it. Now, we say, just on that clearly entertaining, you have to look at Jeans and Henderson to see what the court had before it then. In that case, Jeans, for whatever the reason, not wanting to get into state court with his claims, filed a suit in the Northern District of Texas, and alleging 10b-5 violations, securities law violations, and five purely stateside claims, the state-related claims, securities, Texas law, and all the other stuff, common law fraud. In the prior action, the court entertained all of those, and no question was raised concerning whether they could or would not have been entertained. They were entertained. the new action by Jeans after he lost that litigation in the state courts undertook to allege a whole side actions against Henderson and Stallworth, a gentleman named Stallworth. The court, this court, first held that the federal law controlled on the interpretation of what privity is necessary, or what is necessary, for the benefit of res judicata. And they primarily focused on Mr. Henderson, who was a litigant and a party in the prior action. The questions in the first litigation involved an investment contract between Mr. Jeans and Mr. Henderson and Henderson's partners. And there was an attack upon that on the securities law in the prior federal action. And there were claims by Jeans against Henderson that he had defrauded them into entering into the agreement and into subsequent agreements in the prior action. And as to those claims centering around that 1971 investment contract, this court held by reasoning that those claims were pendant to that affirmative litigation sought in the prior action as pendant claims jurisdiction, that they could and certainly would have been entertained. Ergo, Henderson in the second case could attach himself to those findings that could have been asserted, claims that could have been asserted against him in the prior action. The court went further to discuss the claims of Jeans against Stallworth. Now, Mr. Stallworth had entered into an agreement with Mr. Henderson whereby he, Stallworth, got 77.5% of the working interest that the Henderson Group had in the Loki lease area. And he warranted it. He was a successor in interest to a party in the prior action. This court held that as to Stallworth, considering his claim as pendant party jurisdiction, not pendant to the case, that because he did, their stateside claims, they were not federal claims. And what the court held as a pendant party and developed the premise of a pendant party, that there's no way to believe, or they haven't proved, he clearly would not have entertained those claims related to the 1971 investment contract. But this court did not let him off the hook on matters asserted in the second case that were not related to that 71 contract. Now, what's the significance of that? The court clearly indicates it would not have entertained res judicata as applied to Mr. Stallworth if he did not have a privy relationship with the primary party Henderson from whom he had attained the assignment. And concluded that as to that feature, because he was a successor, and because his claim had been warranted, which would have necessitated circumlocution of lawsuits, if Dean could catch Stallworth in his warranty and coming back in, and held that he could get off of matters relating to the 1971 contract. But mind you, and this seems fundamentally important to us, this court did not hold or suggest that it had any power to determine that there was res judicata rights as to Stallworth, but for saying, quote, "This is a classical case of pendant party jurisdiction." That's the only basis. If you had thought he just came in as a successor in interest and was entitled to all those benefits that Henderson got from the prior judge, there wouldn't have been any reason to talk about pendant party. Now this claim in which we are involved, if it is anything, is a pendant party case. We were sued, not the suors. We defended against the notes, and there were no pendant claims pending, and that could have been pending in the federal court in the prior action. Now, this is not to say that under federal joinder rules that we could not have permissibly joined all these directors in the prior action. But it is to say, the question, what would happen to federal jurisdiction if that's all you had to do is have a federal claim against one and then bring in everybody? So the first step in res judicata is the matter of whether or not there is privity. This question of clearly would not have entertained doesn't even enter into it. The Supreme Court recently held that pendant party jurisdiction in a case like this just doesn't exist, and there should be no retention for purposes of disposing of that.
What in theory is the difference between a successor in interest and predecessor in interest? The purposes of race to come.
Well, if we are going to pay slaves to the federal courts, the predecessor who has divorced himself and dissociated himself or has no interest is certainly not in the same position as somebody who wants to control the litigation or who has a continuing interest in it on the basis of the cause of action asserted. That lest he be a successor in interest or somebody who has some control of the litigation, there is no basis, maybe collateral estoppel judge act, but not the res judicata, extending a prior cause not even similar or related to these, to the protection of some non-party. And let me make this clear. Since the decision of this court in James, there have been at least four cases in the Fifth Circuit that have established exactly what is meant by privity. And while they don't disagree with Southwest Airlines, which this court cited in James as a basis for saying privity is and in effect gone, and we look at the special relationships, they fully explain that case and that holding. And those cases we have cited, they recently in Benson and Ford versus Wanda Petroleum, Judge Reilly used to sit on this court, wrote extensively on this question, on these cases, and held there had to be either the same type of cause of action, had to be the identity of parties, and there had to be, for res judicata purposes, a guy that either controlled the prior litigation or that somebody in that lawsuit represented his interest. The most, and in that case, I found out that did not exist on circumstances much more favorable than these folks have before you today. And it's so much better because you read better than me, and B, you understand better. But those cases, the most recent of which is the Lubrizol case of the Fifth Circuit that you cited, hold A, if we didn't bring the case, there isn't even pendent jurisdiction. B, that these same principles apply. That is privity. And in that case, in an effort to get, and they cite Southwest, as did Judge Reveley in the Ford and Benson case. Those cases clearly hold. And as did Lubrizol holds not only who institutes it, but they made an exception because of a special relationship between Exxon's employees. And that suit, Lubrizol sued, it had litigation in New Jersey in the federal court. And then Lubrizol sued in Texas against Exxon, who had been a party up there, and two employees charged with doing the thing. And a related party against whom they alleged conspiracy. And the Fifth Circuit said, irrespective of the limitations of our prior decisions, including Benson, that we will not we will extend the protection of the prior judgment under res judicata principles to these people that are employees and in that special relation, but that's as far as we go. Otherwise, the rule of privity as it stands still goes. So,
perhaps the directors of the Midland Bank might have some complaint if the FDIC didn't defend the fraud claim against them aggressively enough, but doesn't the Eagle Group in this case have as much incentive to prove fraud against the FDIC as it does to prove fraud against the Midland Bank or the directors of the bank?
But that you're getting down to whether it's the same cause of action, Judge. It's a different cause of action when you're talking about the directors from the management, but even if they're the same, one and the same, you still must have, when a non-party must have that privity that protects him, absent being a party in control, the party whose interest is represented, which means by a party to it. And he, you can't, I mean, I don't see anybody can say FDIC did that. Was doing that for the benefit of these directors. They were trying to resist the claims, but and were not trying to represent their interests. In all events, on that principle of what is privity in the Fifth Circuit and what these pronouncements are, if we're going to follow federal law.
But what I'm saying to you is the purpose of privity is to be sure that the parties who are affected by the judgment got to have a say in what that judgment is going to be. And in this case, doesn't the Eagle Group have every bit the same interest in proving fraud against the FDIC as it did against the FDIC's predecessor or the controller?
Judge Hick, I think, Hick, all I can say is in the decision, the one over Benson and Ford versus Wanda Petroleum. Judge Reveley in that panel directly addressed them and said, it is not enough that their interest is parallel or equal in the defense of that case. And I mean, I just can't say it any better or different. And I'm saying that's what the federal law is. And if we're going to be bound by it, that's, I don't know anywhere else to go. But that, and there must be some protective interest in which they participate, and I don't think anybody would think. I sure wish I could have said something about the collateral estoppel questions, but I guess I can't.
We'll have an opportunity to hear from you in a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah. Court is now ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the Court, Mr. James Paulson and Mr. David Edges will present argument for respondents. Mr. Paulson will open.
May it please the Court. I represent Texas Commerce Bank and Mr. Figueri with the NCMB Texas, and Mr. McElhaney with Pete Marwick have requested that I represent their positions as well. This is meant to be a very brief cameo appearance, and I expect that counsel for the outside directors will probably shoot me if it is anything more. I am only speaking to point of error 4, which is the statute of limitations point, and it is a point that this Court did not grant on. I know in this court's practice that that is a strong hint, but never a promise, as to the way the decision might come down. Given the fact that Mr. Kronzer spoke about the statute of limitations first, I think in an excess of caution, I would like to speak about it for a moment. First of all, Mr. Kronzer mentioned the possibility that fraud might be governed by a four-year rather than a two-year statute of limitations. You will not find that argument briefed in any of our briefs before the Texas Supreme Court. The reason for that, frankly, is that we thought that Mr. Kronzer had given it up once he lost it in the Court of Appeals. In looking at my brief just a moment ago, the application for the writ of error filed by Mr. Kronzer, I think that was more than a tactical decision. I think it was a judicial admission. On page 42, he says that respondents, that's us, quote, had the burden of proving the petitioner's causes of action accrued more than 2 years before the initial suit was filed. That is a two-year statute admitted in his application for writ of error. If the court has any interest at all, of course, they are referred to our briefs. You are referred to our briefs in the Court of Appeals, which discuss it extensively. We did not rely on the Willis versus Maverick case as any sort of a last-minute salvation for our position. We had Texas Supreme Court authority, Fifth Circuit authority, and most other courts of appeals other than El Paso, which now that it has withdrawn its opinion, is unanimous. The torts, including fraud, are a two-year statute of limitations. The only other question is the facts, whether we were able to prove factually that the statute of limitations had run. I would like to make only a couple of quick points. First, there was no fact issue in this case because petitioners presented not one fact on the statute of limitations. No evidence, no affidavits, no exhibits, no nothing, versus several hundred pages of documentary and deposition testimony presented by the respondents in this case. You cannot have a fact issue without a fact. And it is not only actual knowledge, it is constructive knowledge, when they should have known of their claim. That's an issue here, and that is something a judge can properly decide as a matter of law. And you do have a matter of law when people like Judge Lucius Bunton in a public decision say it was a matter of common knowledge in Texas. When the Wall Street Journal 6 months beforehand said that the bank building was sold for many million dollars more than its appraised value and said that it was a surprising transaction. You have proxy statements. You have members of the board of directors talking about withdrawing their own funds. You have possibilities of fraud discussed in partnership meetings many months before the statute of limitations. That is what you had in this case. And that was not a fact issue. Those were facts established as a matter of law.
If the four-year statute applied, would you lose?
If the four-year statute in fact applied, definitely. It would be a rather landmark decision if the four-year statute were to apply them. And it would be contrary to decisions of this court in 1986 and 1989.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
I please the court. Mr. David Hedges will continue arguing for his father.
May it please the court. I'm David Hedges, speaking for the former outside directors of the First National Bank of Midland. With me on the case are Professor Charles Allen Wright, Bill Browder, our Midland counsel, and David Holmes and Margaret Lane from Vinson and Elkins. To speak first briefly to Justice Heck's question, of course the incentive was the same. Eagle was facing a $25 million claim. They had every incentive, as shown by Judge Bunton's decision, to fight to the death, and they did on that issue. So it was.
But I suppose if the decision had gone the other way, that the directors would be challenging the privity requirement of res judicata.
We absolutely would, because you would have what I think is unprecedented, and that is a case of offensive collateral estoppel asserted against a non-party. You have due process arguments there that I'll speak to in a moment that certainly do not arise here. I'm not aware of such a case where offensive collateral estoppel has been committed against a non-party. I'm sure they would have tried it, but I don't believe there is such a case.
I'm talking about res judicata, the question of fraud. If Judge Bunton had found that there was fraud in this case, that the Midland Bank had committed fraud, and then the Eagle Group filed suit in state court for any additional damages to which they might be entitled, and claimed that liability was established as a matter of res judicata, I take it you would contend that was not true.
He was certainly arguing very hard. That takes me to Mr. Cronzer's point, the Benson and Ford case that he keeps relying on so heavily. It's our position that Benson and Ford has absolutely no applicability here. Benson and Ford and Southwest Airlines versus Texas Air and a number of other cases they deal with the question of binding a non-party, somebody who has not had his day in court. That raises obvious due process and fairness arguments that simply are not present here. This is a case such as Jeans versus Henderson and the recent Lubrizol case where you're talking about, as Mr. Cronzer correctly pointed out when he first started out, but then he got away from this, you're talking about where the party to be bound has had his day in court. There's no unfairness to him. He's had his day in court. Eagle has tried this case, and the only question presented is whether a non-party to the first trial, here are the directors, may take advantage of that judgment. So Benson and Ford sets out three very narrow criteria where there's privity between a party to the first case and a non-party for purposes of binding a non-party. You know, he just hadn't had his day in court. There are obviously due process concerns, and those are discussed at length in Benson and Ford and in Southwest Airlines, both by the Fifth Circuit. Those concerns are not present here, and that was recognized by this court in Jeans, which is an opinion that has been commented on favorably by Professor Wright and other treatise writers, and we urge you to stick with, because we win if you stick with it. Lubrizol, which was decided here recently by the Fifth Circuit in May of 1989, supports Jeans. In Jeans, this court said, quoting from Professor Wright, that once it's determined that a party to the first case may be bound, then the only inquiry is whether there is some special reason to deny the benefit of res judicata to the party asserting it. Here are the directors. That is not the Benson and Ford analysis. We submit that here there is no special reason. This case, as I think Justice Heck noted, it was tried just the same as if the bank had been there. All of Eagle's claims were against the bank. They weren't really against the FDIC. The alleged fraud occurred when the bank was open. These directors were running it. The conduct that they complain of, the transaction that Eagle complains of, occurred while the directors were in control of the bank, and they say the directors defrauded them. They don't say the FDIC defrauded them. So it is really, a meaningless distinction that the plaintiff happened to be the FDIC. As it turned out, the bank failed before Eagle defaulted on the note. Therefore, the FDIC is the receiver of the bank and the successor to the bank had taken over and happened to be the party in that lawsuit. Res judicata is a doctrine of judicial economy. And basically what Mr. Cronzer and what Eagle is arguing is that this court should permit them to retry precisely the same case, the same evidence, the same witnesses, the same cause of action, just because of the happenstance that they litigated it the first time against the FDIC and not against the bank. We suggest that that is grossly unfair to the directors, is totally against the doctrine of judicial economy, which is the whole purpose for res judicata. For somebody to get to engage in a year of discovery, try a case to an experienced federal judge with no jury, where all the evidence came in, it was fully and fairly litigated despite their complaints to the contrary, and then just because of what's little more than a technicality, to get to try their case again. I think they make some attempt to say, well, this isn't even the same cause of action. Of course it's the same cause of action. They're arguing about the same transaction. The Fifth Circuit, it's undisputed, applies the transactional test. The transaction here is a sale-leaseback transaction. In the first case, they said the directors of the bank defrauded us in entering into this transaction. They defrauded us into funding these letters of credit early. That is precisely what they argue here. The only way they try to get around that is to say, oh, this was a suit on a note. Well, that ignores the counterclaim. It was interesting to hear Mr. Cronzer admit today there was a counterclaim. It's rarely mentioned in their brief. But they filed a counterclaim. They chose to counterclaim against the FDIC, and they made the very same fraud charges in that counterclaim that they're making here in this case. And under a Fourth Circuit case, a recent Fourth Circuit case we cite in our brief, under the restatement and Professor Wright's treatise, A counterclaim is treated just like a petition, just like a complaint for purposes of res judicata. Now, Mr. Cronzer tried to sort of dance around that. He called it a third cross action, what have you. A counterclaim has preclusive effect. They tried this case just as if it had been, as if they had been the plaintiff. There's no difference for purposes of res judicata. Interestingly, in their briefs and in the argument, they suggest that maybe Judge Bunton wouldn't have heard this case, or he wouldn't have had jurisdiction over it. Number one, we point out in our brief and in the Teague affidavit attached to the brief, 3 or 4 weeks before they filed this counterclaim, their lawyers came to us and said, we're going to sue you. We're going to sue you in federal court. We're going to sue you for securities fraud. We're going to sue you for common law negligence. We're going to append various state law claims. So they knew perfectly well that Judge Bunton had jurisdiction over this claim. Moreover, it was interesting to hear them today mention that there was a securities fraud claim. That doesn't show up except one place in scores of pages of briefs. That's why clearly Judge Bunton had jurisdiction over the directors. Federal courts, as you well know, have exclusive jurisdiction over federal securities law claims. They had a federal securities law claim against the FDIC, and they appended to it their various state law claims, same claims that they're asserting in this case, their common law fraud claims, were appended to their claims against the FDIC. All they had to do was file the same in their counterclaim, name the directors, very liberal joinder under the federal rules, under both rules 13 and 20. We would have been counterclaim defendants. Judge Bunton would have taken it because he had exclusive jurisdiction. He would have taken pendant claim jurisdiction of the state law claims. Again, the very same state law claims that were already alleged and in fact litigated against the FDIC would have been appended to their federal securities law claim against the directors. It is sheer speculation that Judge Bunton would not have heard it because it might have taken a day longer or what have you. I suggest it probably wouldn't have. It would have been the same evidence. A number of the directors, in fact, testified at trial.
If it had taken a day longer, he probably wouldn't have heard it.
Judge Bunton enjoys trying cases, or seems to. I think he would have.
With celerity. A DTPA action was not asserted in the counterclaim.
It was not.
Is the analysis the same as to it?
Absolutely. It would have been a pendant state claim. It would have been based on the same fact, the same transaction, the same conduct. Yes, it would have been.
What about collateral estoppel as to it? Been talking about race to counsel.
They argue that for purposes of collateral estoppel, that the issues were not the same because the DTPA raises issues that were not raised by the common law fraud claim. I think that's the bottom line. We would suggest that it is barred, the DTPA claim is barred by collateral estoppel to begin with. The federal law does control here. There's just absolutely no dispute. As I understand it, they've abandoned that. I will not argue it. But under federal law, the courts have said that an issue is defined by the transaction, by the conduct, and by the harm that is charged. Here, again, it's undisputed. The DTPA claim is based on the very same facts and transactions. We would also, the same facts being the fraud to enter into the building transaction and the fraud to enter into the early funding. In addition, this court and the federal courts have said repeatedly that one purpose of collateral estoppel and res judicata is to prevent inconsistent findings by the court on the same issue, by the courts. Judge Bunton found that these Eagle partners were not defrauded into buying the building, not defrauded into funding the letters of credit early. The DTPA claim in this case seeks to get a determination that they were in fact deceived in entering into those transactions. If ever there were inconsistent holdings, this would be it. As Professor Wright has stated and others, one of the purposes of collateral estoppel and res judicata are to protect the courts, protect respect for the courts, so that you don't have Court A deciding something one way and a week later Court B deciding the same issue on the same facts differently across the street. That's precisely what would happen here. This is a highly publicized case. It was tried before Judge Bunton. If they can come back 5 years later, walk two blocks down the street, try the identical case just because they've changed its name and call it DTPA rather than common law fraud. We suggest that that violates the concept of collateral estoppel and could reduce respect for the courts.
You don't say those actions are anywhere close to the same, do you?
They are very close to the same. Certainly there are some within the DTPA, there are some issues that are not necessarily decided by a common law in a common law fraud decision. But we say that here, because the transaction is the same, the harm is the same, the conduct is the same in the Bonnywell case, decided by this court and cited by Mr. Kronzer, the court focused on the conduct at issue. It said that there was no collateral estoppel there because the conduct in the first case was different from the I'm thinking of Tarter versus Metropolitan Life, not Bonnywell. This court focused on the conduct and found that collateral estoppel did not apply because the conduct was the same. But here, the conduct is exactly the same in both cases. So we submit that under collateral estoppel, it is barred, Justice Wright.
Counsel, I'm looking at page 6 of the brief filed by Mr. Kronzer, and it contains this statement. The court ruled that the statements made by Charles Frazier concerning the existence of an appraisal supporting a $75 million value for the bank were false, were factual, false, and material. However, it then noted that the following. The difficulty the court has is that none of the four who heard this representation either demanded to see the appraisal. Okay, well, on a fraud, I can understand where the court's coming from, but under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, if it were a laundry list violation, for instance, the very act alone of making the statement is sufficient. They don't have to demand to see it because you don't have the common law defenses or anything.
Maybe, Your Honor. Let me suggest that, one, I hope you don't reach that because I think we went on res judicata where we have a classic case and you won't have to reach collateral estoppel. Let me suggest, secondly, that I think the one place the federal law and the state law may differ, and I think that's why Mr. Kronzer argued for state law, is that the state courts do give a more narrow interpretation for collateral estoppel purposes to what is an issue. It's almost each issue submitted to the jury. I would submit that under the federal law, the courts have taken a much broader view of what is an issue. It's almost a definition of more like what is a claim for purposes of res judicata. So that's about the best I can say on that. Let me just touch it. Yes.
Coming back to your pendant party,
pendant claim, Your Honor.
Well, I was going to focus on pendant party. Do you agree that Finley pretty well does that in, or?
Not think there's some hope left for it.
Well, we don't at all. I suppose it remains to be seen and whether Finley is limited to just the Federal Tort Claims Act. But we have found no precedent. I just can't believe there's any that the question here is would Judge Munton have heard these claims back in March of 1985 just because Finley cast a doubt on the pendant party jurisdiction in May of 89. I don't think that takes them anywhere.
Well, that's the question. I know you make that argument, but isn't the question whether the claim was hearable rather than whether Judge Bunton would have heard it? Surely we're not applying subjective to it.
Well, it was hearable at the time because at that time the Fifth Circuit and every circuit but the Ninth Circuit recognized pendant party jurisdiction. And not to be redundant at all, but let me just make clear that we argue you don't even have to reach the pendant party point. Sure you understand, because of the federal securities law claim to which these state claims could have been appended, you don't even need to reach it. But we would argue strongly that Finley may have changed the laws in May 1989, but not as of the time of this lawsuit. Let me touch briefly on the state law versus federal law point, because I do think it's important, frankly, because we do, while there's very little difference in the two, there are some minor differences. There's no case out there that says that when you've got a federal judgment that should be treated differently for purposes of res judicata and collateral estoppel, that state law applies to one and federal to the other. Mr. Kronzer jumped on a single paragraph in this court's Jeans decision. Jeans was a res judicata decision. The court said that federal law controls the res judicata effect of a prior federal judgment. but in a single paragraph in briefly discussing collateral estoppel, in passing, it cited a state court case. And that is his sole authority. Such a holding by this court would have been monumental, contrary to all authority, and it's simply inconceivable that this court would have intended to make such a holding simply by a passing reference. And I suggest that that's, Mr. Pronger seemed to abandon that today, so I don't want to hammer on that, but certainly federal law does in fact control here. Are there any questions? We still have a moment left on the collateral estoppel point. Again, I just remind the court it's an alternative ground the court will not need to reach if we prevail on res judicata. Just in closing, I would say that what we're talking about here is virtually a classic case of res judicata. The only argument they have made is that, gosh, the FDIC was there and not the bank. They have never suggested one logical or legal reason why that should make any difference. They had their day in court. They litigated the case just as they would have litigated it against the bank. Let me just emphasize once more, all this lengthy briefing they do about fairness and manifest injustice are cases like Park Lane against Shore, offensive collateral estoppel, Benson and Ford versus Wanda, binding a non-party, Southwest Airlines, binding a non-party. We've all practiced law a long time. When you start talking about binding somebody who has not had his day in court, that's a big matter. And these courts have talked about due process and fairness. But it's no big deal to bind somebody who's already had his day in court. The only question is the question dealt with in Lubrizol and Engine, is there some special reason that these directors who didn't happen to be there in the first trial should not be permitted to take advantage of that judgment? And we submit to you that they have not suggested any such reason. They were the directors of the very bank. Their conduct was at issue in the first trial. Lubrizol, just mention Lubrizol briefly, and then I'll give you back a minute or two of your time. Lubrizol's facts were virtually identical to the facts we have here. It was a vicarious liability case, just like this is a vicarious liability case. Lubrizol asserted that it had been defrauded by Exxon as a result of the conduct of Exxon employees. Here, Eagle argues that it was defrauded by the bank as a result of the conduct of the bank officers and directors. Lubrizol found that there was privity between the two employees and Exxon because of this vicarious liability relationship. We argue here that there's privity between the directors and the bank, and ergo its successor, the FDIC, because of the vicarious liability situation. So those cases are essentially the same. Eagle has argued that, Gene is limited to its facts. Lubrizol is limited to its facts. But neither of those cases indicate that they are limited to the particular facts in the case. In fact, Lubrizol cites a number of other cases, none of which involve employer-employee relationship. They're co-conspirators. You can't sue one conspirator and then come back and sue another one in another case. A number of different fact situations that indicate that it is not and is not intended to be so narrowly limited.
I just have to, you made the statement that if you prevail on res judicata, you don't need to issue the, don't need to reach the issue of collateral estoppel. Wouldn't it be just the reverse? Because isn't collateral estoppel, or the synonymous term is issue preclusion, isn't that really just a miniature res judicata?
No, it's really not, Your Honor. Res judicata bars the entire claim, the entire cause of action,
right.
Everything they could have brought or could have brought.
The lawsuit.
The entire lawsuit is gone. Collateral estoppel is more narrow. It's just the various issues that were decided.
That's right. That's what I'm saying. Collateral estoppel is merely really a miniature res judicata.
Oh, yes. I think that's right.
Okay.
I mean, it's conceivable that under collateral estoppel that there might have been certain things decided, but something might be carved out that somehow wasn't decided.
Thank you.
Would the claim now being asserted in state court be barred by res judicata if the counterclaim had not been asserted in the federal court?
Your Honor, that is a tough question that Professor Wright and others have written a good deal on, namely if it had been raised as an affirmative defense as opposed to a counterclaim.
Or not even asserted.
Not, well, if it had been not even asserted, I think probably the argument is it would not be. Where there's a counterclaim, though, it's just like a lawsuit, it's just like a complaint, and they're bound. If they had raised a fraud as an affirmative defense, I would argue there's no different. I've seen some of the treatise writers have said that might make a difference.
Thank you,
Governor.
Any other questions?
May it please the Court. If the last response that was made by Mr. Hedges, Justice Heck, is the case, that is, res judicata would not be applicable if there had been no counterclaim. If they just had been nothing said in the prior Bunton suit on the basis of the claim that we tried to defend against the FDIC, that there would be no reaching offense of res judicata, I fail to understand the other side of that coin. It was asserted defensively. It was not asserted to protect, help, assist the directors. It was responsive to the fraud claims against management. And if they are correct, that DTPA claims, which don't require fraud or reliance, either one, and all of the causes of action stateside that are now asserted are wiped out, then that means that these parties trying to defend themselves on this note were wiped out because they tried to defend against it and did not bring in these all these different stateside claims with which the FDIC had zero interest. Now, if that's res judicata in the federal system, you're going to have to overrule Jenkins.
Why did the FDIC have zero interest?
They don't have any interest in our private stateside claims with these folks. That's what I mean.
Well, in the federal suit, the collection of their notes depends on it, didn't it?
I'm not saying issue-wise. We're talking now about cause of action-wise. And I hate to be this bold, but I will rest my case on Lubrizol. And they're big on Lubrizol because, unlike what he told the court a bit ago, that there is a distinction to be made whether the non-party is bound or not to be bound. Lubrizol is a case in which the prior action had been tried and lost by the plaintiff, and the court put it down where anybody can understand it, that absent a special relationship as developed in Benson and Ford, as developed in all these cases, there can't be any application of res judicata. These were employees who did the dirty work up in New Jersey. And they were protected, but the third party to that troika was not in Lubrizol. And there is no distinction between the requirements of res judicata in the federal system between offensive and defensively applied. In collateral estoppel here, which we didn't touch on, we say again, the determination of the fraud issue was not necessary to the judgment because there was an alternate finding of holder in due course. The alternate finding of Section 27 of the restatement is discussed in Hicks versus Quaker Oaks. True, that was an offensive collateral estoppel case. But the court made no distinction or saying it should be different. The reason that's so is the same as you had in Bonnywell. You determined that one of the bases for the ultimate decision was that the decision wiping out the plaintiffs in the Wilcox dispute in Galveston was not necessary to the judgment. They got exonerated, and so therefore it wasn't necessary for them to get off the hook. There must be an ultimate finding that is necessary to the judgment. This one is not. But when you come down hard on collateral estoppel, and I just don't have time or and also incapable of articulating if Park Lane and Smithwick mean anything. Collateral estoppel is a fairness question. And if it's fair to deprive these men of all their state causes of action because they asserted a counterclaim on the note, then I'm saying fairness has gone down the pipe. Those cases mean nothing. Smithwick and Parkland. Here are some men that get on big obligations at the 11th hour, not told the truth about it, and are going to now be denied because they couldn't get, they could have brought their cases in the federal court. And let's put that down. I didn't raise this about Judge Bunn. But if there's anybody within the hearing of my voice, or to whom I can write a letter, that believes Judge Wood have entertained these collateral DTPA claims in the federal government's attempt to get that note, I'll just put in this. Thank you.
Can you address the two-year versus the four-year question?
Yes, Judge. What, as you know, that limitations was amended to say fraud is a debt, the statute was, and we claim that this type of fraud is a debt. The Court of Appeals has held that the El Paso Court withdrew it after your Willis versus Maverick because of the broad language in there. Any tort matter still goes under the two-year statute, but not against this attack. The other, it may be true that these men knew something bad was happening to them from the papers and FDIC trying to collect from them. But the extent of the fraud has just recently revealed itself, and you have it before you in Judge Bunton's latest findings. And to deny these fellows their, they may lose, but they're day in court over the fact they filed a cross-claim or counterclaim in against the feds. Doesn't even begin to be fair as far as we see it. Thank you, though, for the time you've given us again, and I appreciate your audience.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second clause. The court will take another recess.
I need to be right.